To access films and other visual media, visually impaired people currently rely on audio description, a separate soundtrack describing what's seen on the screen. Dr. Mariana Lopez is a postdoctoral researcher at the Culture of the Digital Economy Research Institute in Anglia Ruskin University. She's researching the potential of a new medium to portray story, action, and interaction solely through sound, sound processing, and spatialization. The new technique uses surround sound and other audio technologies to place the listener in the center of the action, with specific audio cues employed to establish a sense of place, character, and mood. Here, Mariana discusses her research with Dr. Susan Blakeney, clinical advisor to the College of Optometrists.
So, Mariana, welcome to OQ. I understand your background is in sound design and on the acoustics of performance spaces. What made you decide to explore the concept of an audio film?
Well, the idea first came when I was master's student at the University of York here in the UK. And it was actually part of my dissertation for my master's. And it was an idea we developed together with my academic supervisor at the time. And I think what we were trying to explore is how you could tell a story without needing any visuals, and with the challenges that that implies. So how do you explore kind of complex sound ideas? What do you do when the object doesn't exist, maybe in reality, or we're not used to it? And I became very interested in how that could be applied to thinking about accessibility. So what if a person wants to enjoy a film but can't actually see the visuals? Is there an alternative to audio description?
Do you think there's anything wrong with the conventional audio description that we're all used to now?
I think the first thing to bear in mind is that the minute is the only way of providing visually impaired audiences with a way of experiencing film and television. So that's very valuable in itself. So it does play an important role, I think. But I think we need to see about whether we are providing them just with an informative experience, or is that also an entertaining experience? Because if you're watching a film or a TV show, you want not to just be informed of what's happening. You want to have a good time, as we all want to when we go to the cinema. And at the minute, I'm not sure that's actually happening. And a lot of the audio description tracks are very matter of fact. You know, there is a vase on the left and it's that colour. And sometimes it's even, in my opinion, it's drowning some of the information that is in the soundtrack that could potentially be interpreted maybe without a description.
So how do you tell the stories with sound? Could you give us an outline of the techniques that you use?
Yes, well, we use a few things. I mean, the first thing to think about is how we construct kind of the main elements, sound elements in the film. And one of them is a dialogue. So the characters do speak. They have dialogues like in normal films. They also have internal monologues. So we might have a character expressing a fear or a desire or anything else. We worked also a lot with kind of internal sounds. So someone breathing can give us a lot of information on whether they're upset, they're happy, or they're worried about something. Then we also worked a lot with sound effects. The sound effects are used in this context either to make us aware that there's an object in a room, maybe a character interacting with an object, maybe picking up something from the floor or leaving groceries on a table. But they were also used for something that we called sound marks. So sound mark is a bit like a landmark. It tells us what a space is, and it helps us remember it. So in the particular example that we tested, a clock was used to let the listeners know that they were in the living room. So every time our character returned to the living room, that was the sound mark. That's how they knew, hopefully, that the character was there. Another thing we used a lot was atmosphere. So when the characters are in a living room, but they're in a city, we could hear the traffic coming through the windows. And then when they go into the street, we can hear that much louder and unfiltered. So that became an important part of it. Music was also used to clue listeners as to what was happening. So, for example, if it was a tense moment, we would change the music to reflect those feelings. We also used what's called artificial reverberation, which is basically trying to apply to a sound, either a line of dialogue or it could be footsteps or a sound effect, the acoustic characteristics of a space, so that the listener knows if they're in a small space, in a large space, So if we go to a cathedral, it doesn't sound the same that we are in a studio. So that's what we try to use to help people know that the characters had moved. And the last but very important part was the use of surround sound systems. So things like 5.1. In this case, we use 6.1. That is kind of another version of surround sound. And the idea was to give information of where objects were. So, for example, if there was a clock in the centre of the room, or if there was a door on the rear at the left. But it also helped us tell the listeners where a character was going to, so where they were moving to and from.
So do you have a clip that we could hear?
Yes, sure. We can listen to a very short extract from the example we've been testing that is called Lamb to the Slaughter, and it's based on a short story by Roald Dahl that very briefly tells the story of someone called Mary Maloney, who one day when she's in her house, her husband arrives, tells her he's going to leave her, and she gets quite upset, and in a kind of a moment of shock, she kills him with a frozen leg of lamb by hitting him in the head, and then covers up the murder by feeding the murder weapon to the police. So the clip we're going to listen to is the actual murder scene. So it's the moment where Mary hits her husband, Patrick, in the head with a frozen leg of lamb, and he falls to the floor. And something to bear in mind is that this is a stereo version of that clip, but the original one is intended to be experienced in a surround sound system so that we can actually hear Mary pacing up and down the room, and we can also see where she's positioned in relation to her husband.
I killed him. Okay, yes, I know what they'll do to me. I don't care. In fact, it would be a relief. But what about the child? What will they do with the child?
OK, so what sort of trials have you done so far?
Well, last year we trialled the example of the audio film, A Lamb to the Slaughter, with a group of 9 visually impaired volunteers. We asked them some general questions about what their experience was with audio description, whether they experienced it on television, in the cinema, and they were very open questions where if they wanted to add comments, then we could blog them separately. So they asked these very general questions, and then they were invited to listen to the piece, which was about 15 minutes, and they would sit at the centre, at the acoustic sweet spot, basically. And then I would ask them the questions about what they have listened to. And they weren't given much information beforehand. They knew it was going to be a piece, but they didn't know what it was about. They knew it was going to be 15 minutes. That's all they knew. And one of the things we asked is whether they were already familiar with the story, because we wanted to know whether the understanding of the plot had to do with the fact that they already knew what was going to happen, or it had to do with the audio. And then we went on to ask questions about the plot in itself, how clear it was for them, and we asked them to summarise it. And this allowed us to test whether the main plot elements had actually come through clearly. We were also quite interested in rating the enjoyment. And they were asked about the characters they identified, so either names or descriptions were fine, and how they identified. So was it the voices? Was it maybe the accents of the characters? Was it the gender? Or was it anything else, maybe? They were also asked about the physical spaces, so say a living room, a kitchen, a bedroom, a shop. So what they recognised and how they recognised them. And we also had questions about sound effects. So did they think all the sound effects were clear? Did they at all moments know what they were listening to? Or were there any moments where they thought, actually, I don't know what that was? So we were also interested in that. And interestingly enough, we also followed up that question with whether that was a problem or not. So if they weren't clear about a specific sound effect, did they feel that was a problem for their enjoyment of the piece? Which actually most people felt it wasn't, that even if they missed on one particular object, actually, they still followed the plot and they didn't think it was a problem.
So what works particularly well, and are there any kinks that need to be ironed out still?
One of the most interesting things for me is that the volunteers that came to do the tests and take part in the experience thought it was enjoyable. And to me that was key, because if you're thinking about a format that allows visually impaired people to access a form of entertainment, if it's not entertaining, it's not very useful. So actually 100% of the volunteers said that they found it enjoyable. And they found the stories we produced easy to follow what was happening as well. At different levels, of course, but the majority of the people said it was easy to follow. And all of them commented about how wonderful they thought the experience of surround sound was, because, of course, it's not something many people are used to. So that worked very well. I mean, one of the things that needs more work is in the story we worked with, when the characters change from one space to the other, so, for example, from a living room to the kitchen or to a bedroom, we found that most volunteers found it very difficult to tell that there had been a change. So I think that needs a lot more work, maybe in identifying exactly how we can let listeners know, OK, there's been a change, something more equivalent to a cut in a film. Yeah. So we're still working on how to sort that out.
When people first hear an audio film, does it take them any time to get used to it, or do they sort of get it straight away?
I think with every kind of arts experience, there is a process of getting used to something. So the test actually showed that the context played a key part in people understanding what was happening. So maybe in the first few seconds, they weren't really sure what the story was going to be about. But then the context slowly started cluing them in on this. But when films began being made, actually, people weren't that familiar with the conventions. So there's a little bit of that in this sort of project. It's through exposure and getting used to the conventions of a format that it's going to become easier for people to follow them. So if we made loads of audio films and people became used to hearing them, they would be easier to follow.
So do you think it's likely that this is going to become mainstream? And if so, the optometrists will be asked about it by their visually impaired patients?
I don't think it's going to replace normal things. I think it could be applied in a parallel way to people looking for a different experience, even in a setting that maybe it's not a cinema, maybe it's a gallery it's a museum or something like that. Well, what I do hope is that at least the research we're doing becomes known. And we have been very lucky with getting help from RNIB, Action for Blind People, who have actually helped us secure the volunteers for a project, as well as our local charity that's CAMSight. But of course, things in the creative industries, it takes a while for the industry to actually apply new systems because of the cost of changing anything in the workflows. So part of our future work is actually working with a panel of industry advisors and actually ask them how we can make sure that our new systems, if they prove successful, how can they be incorporated to the creative workflows? Because as well, I believe strongly that audio description shouldn't be something that's tacked in at the end of a film. Because at the minute, what happens is you make a film, everything it's done, then it goes to an audio description company who does the audio description. And I highly doubt that anybody from the creative team of the film actually ever listens to that audio description track. Because what happens at the minute is that we've been using the same techniques since more or less the 1970s. At least to design the track, maybe not to play it back. And I find it a bit strange that with all the advancements in technology and audio technology, certainly, the same thing is being done. So I think a key part is also, can we engage audio describers and professionals in accessibility to the creative industries so that they work together in making something that is engaging for the artists, but it's also accessible.
So what are your plans for future research?
Well, I would like, and I'm working on securing funding to make a project at a larger scale, because this was a pilot study, but we think we can start looking more closely at taking a film, thinking about what the audio description track is and what elements can be replaced to make something that works in a more enhanced manner to put it in a simple way. So we're hoping that also that funding is going to allow us to carry out the research, but also engage a larger number of visually impaired people.
What do you see might happen in the future, if there are any other implications of the research?
I think that training videos in the workplace could be an application if a company is recruiting visually impaired employees and the way of training their employees has been mostly visually based. There needs to be a way into providing an equivalent experience for their employees so that they don't feel like they're left out and they can't complete their training. So I think that's something that could be useful for companies.
Finally, do you think that your techniques as a whole have the potential really to completely transform our audiovisual experience and give us a more inclusive experience for everybody?
I think so, in the sense that it is possible with more research, of course, and more tests and checking different ways of doing things, to arrive at a point where a sighted person and a person with a sight loss can actually watch and experience the same film or the same television problem with the same soundtrack. And for me, a key thing is to kind of encourage social inclusivity through the art so that nobody that has sight loss actually feels like they can't experience a filmic experience because of a visual impairment. So that's for me the key, really.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mariana and Susan.